Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We're going to start off with an article that was in yesterday's Guardian, an opinion piece that I just had to share with you. It concerns a certain Michael Floor, a 70-year-old from Seattle. He was an early adopter in COVID and barely survived. He was home and recovering when he got a second shock that nearly killed him, which was his hospital bill, a bill for $1.1 million, as reported the Seattle Times. Now, if we take a look at breaking down that bill, because, you know, it's always fun to ask for an itemized bill, it's $10,000 a day for an intensive care room. It was $400,000 for being in a sterile room for 42 days after that, $82,000 for the use of the ventilator for 29 days, and a couple of days cost $50,000 a day. That was when he received a lot of intensive care. Lucky for him, he's on Medicare. So medical debt will not follow him to the end of his life. But for Janet Mendez, a New Yorker who also nearly died, she barely got out of the hospital when the bills started piling up. She got an invoice for $401,000 from the Mount Sinai Morningside Hospital, who generously said they would reduce the bill down to $75,000. Now, this is a person. She's no longer a patient, but she has a right to be impatient because she can't walk yet, and she's lost her job, and she's starting to get Dunning calls from the hospital. This truly is Kafkaesque. Now, federal funding in that bill that was passed with such fanfare by Congress was supposed to cover the majority of medical bills. The hospitals received major grants, the idea being that they were going to not charge people for their COVID-9 expenses. Well, apparently they didn't quite get the memo. Doctors who treat patients can also send their own bills. See, the doctors don't necessarily work for the hospital. Many of them are private contractors, and many of them are not enrolled in any given patient's health plan. They are an out-of-network doctor, and if you haven't read the fine print on your policy, you probably should, because between copays and the deductibles and the percentage that you owe that the insurance doesn't cover, you may be looking at several luxury McMansions worth of bill. And, oh, by the way, under the Bush administration, they made it illegal for people to declare bankruptcy for health care costs, because we certainly wouldn't want that. There is just no way for me to say how nuts this is. And the aftermath to our economy, if thousands of people have to make payments on massive medical bills, is just unimaginable. If we're trying to recover, believe me, this is a problem we need to throw some money at. This also needs to be for everyone. You know, the people who are like, well, you know, I like my insurance. Yeah, do you? Do you still like your insurance? We need a national healthcare system. We need to be able to let everyone who gets sick or might be sick get tested, get treated. And this has got to be as non-negotiable over the next 5 to 10 years as fixing the police. Both things are massively damaging everyone, all of the citizens. And the absolute absurdity of our healthcare system has never been more apparent. So I hope that if you have any political energy left, please start writing to Congress. Please start writing to your senators. Please, please, we've got to fix this, and we've got to put together a rescue package for the people who are already on the hook for these massive bills. A couple emails this week. I want to start with Aaron from Santa Cruz, who wants to know about coffee and caffeine. A question for the show. Do you recommend or not recommend coffee? What about caffeine pills? Should I be concerned about contaminants in pills? And can you recommend a source? Backstory. I've been drinking lots and lots of coffee and trying to quit for 25 years. I finally managed to quit with a caffeine pill. Now when I wake up, I drink hot water and take one 200 milligram tablet. It's sort of like the nicotine patch for coffee holism. It's very, very brilliant, Aaron. I'm planning to taper down slowly by taking portions of the tablet. My rheumatologist says he's okay with up to 4 cups a day of coffee because it has anti-inflammatory compounds. We haven't discussed the caffeine pills. So let me take a moment and just comment about caffeine and coffee. First of all, 200 milligrams a day is very safe. If you're spreading it out, most people don't start to get twitchy until 600 milligrams of caffeine. But if you're caffeine adapted, then your liver is able to burn through this stuff just like someone who drinks alcohol every day or someone who smokes pot every day. You get faster at burning through it. And so what you're doing with the taper is definitely a good idea. I wanted to mention about coffee. Coffee has an amazing amount of really, really powerful and interesting compounds. And it does have substantial antioxidant properties. In looking that up, I went to, because of course tea also has polyphenols and acids that are good for you, and cocoa does. And I found a study that compared cocoa and tea and coffee in terms of its antioxidant content for a standard method of brewing. And they ran this thing through high performance liquid chromatography, and they did all these chemical tests. So it was very scientific. Coffee won, hands down. It had around twice as much of the healthy antioxidants. Green tea came next, followed by black tea, not far behind, then cocoa. Sorry, herbal tea. You were actually last on the line of healthy antioxidants. Although I will say, I don't know which herbal tea, and obviously there are a lot of different ones. So that may not be a generalizable result. Another interesting thing to know about coffee itself is that coffee will either raise or lower your cholesterol a little bit, depending upon how you make it. If you use a paper filter, there are some oily compounds called terpenes, which absorb onto the paper filter and don't make it into the coffee. The terpenes in coffee actually raise cholesterol and lipids somewhat. That accounts for why in the 80s there were such contradictory results. It so depends on reading that method section in the paper so that you're sure that you're comparing apples to apples. I don't think you're in trouble with the caffeine pills. They are very safe. I wouldn't worry about contaminants as long as they are a pharmaceutical grade, which would be anything sold in a drugstore. This compound is very easy to extract and put into a pill. Our next email came from Pat in Santa Cruz, and I'll just say, I don't screw up that often, but when I do, it's really a doozy. So apologies to the entire audience for confusing you in my comments to a previous email regarding omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. To briefly recap, the author of the email wondered what my opinion was about a article saying that omega-6 fatty acids, that is, that the article called seed oils, were very bad. And you can think of omega-6 fatty acids as a normal component of plants that is concentrated in seeds, but it's also pro-inflammatory. And up until very recently, when the technology existed to crush the seeds and squeeze the oil out of them, nobody in history made seed oils. You just didn't have the juice. You mean you make olive oil by pressing olives in a handmade press. I mean, that goes way back. That goes back to the Fertile Crescent. But you render down whale oil, but and you get cow's milk. And those were the major sources of oil, plus, you know, animal fat, of course, like lard, for most of human history. Once we got those omega-6 goings, we improved the carbohydrate supply in the diet. It was a great breakthrough. It allowed for a higher population, but it also created some fallout into that it was pro-inflammatory. And we know that the omega-3s are less inflammatory. And apparently during my discussion last week, I flipped them and was unclear. So let's clarify. Omega-3, good, lowers inflammation, relatively speaking. Appropriate ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 is like 2-1, and the standard American diet's like 16-1, which makes that a very inflammatory diet. Some, not all omega-6s are bad and pro-inflammatory. Some of them are useful and have come over to the side of the force. So we don't want to vilify them, but we do want to adjust that ratio and try to keep the balance so that we don't get the pro-inflammatory hit from too much omega-6. I'm going to talk now about the conference that I attended last weekend. Regular listeners will know that every year in the spring, I go off to the Institute for Functional Medicine and I come back full of ideas and interesting things that I'm going to try and tell you about. And that's kind of what happened this year. So the first thing that I picked up at this conference was about berberine. Now, berberine is a compound that I use a lot in my diabetics, but I haven't used it much in my patients with high lipids who don't want to be on a statin. That's about to change. One of the things I learned at this conference is that berberine is a PCSK9 inhibitor. The PCSK9 has been, in the last few years, promoted to doctors as a thing. I'd never heard of it before the drug companies started offering to buy me dinner and tell me about it, because they, surprise, surprise, had a drug. Two drugs, in fact, Repatha and Prazulent. And these are both monoclonal antibodies that block PCSK9. Well, they lower cholesterol quite drastically. No one has actually shown that they improve survival, because that requires more lead time than we've had so far. And since many people, myself included, believe that the benefit of statins is the anti-inflammatory piece and not the lipid-lowering piece, it'll be interesting to see where these monoclonals, which are given by biweekly injections, will find their place. They are extraordinarily expensive, of course. And also, they're monoclonal antibodies, which is not a good idea unless you've got a serious track record. We've already seen problems with some of the early monoclonals that have a track record. And so, in my view, this has to prove itself over, oh, let's say a decade, with substantial clinical benefits to offset the substantial cost before it should really become a thing. Don't treat a number, treat a patient. Which brings us to berberine. Berberine is actually also a effective way to lower bad cholesterol and to otherwise improve the appearance of that lab test. Whether we see an improvement in survival, not too clear yet. It hasn't been studied specifically with survival as an endpoint. It has, however, been studied for diabetes. And so if you are looking for a PCSK9 inhibitor, I would go to the health food store and pick up some berberine and some oat bran. If you have high lipids, particularly high LDL, I think would be worth trying a combination of berberine, 500 milligrams, three times a day, by the way, is the dose that it was used in the studies, and that's the diabetes dose. So if you've got diabetes, high blood pressure, or high lipids, this might be something you want to add to your medication balance. And guess where berberine comes from? Golden seal and Oregon grape. And these are compounds that I have heard about from my herbalist friends and my functional medicine friends forever. So I thought I'd throw out a little tidbit right off the top there, talking about that. So the Functional Medicine Conference, very, very interesting because it was virtual. First time they've ever done a virtual conference. And this one was 2 days of solid study and solid lectures and solid slideshows. And I have to say, I will give it I don't particularly like to sit and watch a screen for that kind of time, but the app ran on my phone. I could walk around. I could go sit out on the deck. And they had a little private social media thing going on. So I got to see my friends and I got to see what they were eating and what they were doing while they attended the conference. So it was kind of a nice experience. And the speakers were excellent. It was probably easy to recruit people because they could stay home and didn't have to travel. Obviously, nobody's traveling to go and present at a conference right now. But they got some seriously big, heavy hitters. So I'm going to tell you about the first of those, Nathan Price, who is the head of the Institute of Systems Biology here in Northern California. And he shared with us some of his exciting new research that is going to guide much more efficient personalized medicine, personalized interventions where we're not guessing, we're not extrapolating, we're measuring. And if you can think of, well, for me, I see an analogy. 20th century medicine was kind of a law enforcement model. Let's find those diseases and round them up and control them. 21st century medicine is going to be more of a social services, identify potential problems, prevent crises, and nurture the body so that the diseases don't develop in the first place. Dr. Price is best known for the Pioneer 100 project. This is something that was begun 3 or 4 years ago, around the time that all of these tracking devices sort of reached the ready for prime time zone, so maybe 5 years. And they have a group of well over 100 people now that they have done just extraordinarily deep phenotyping. So what that means, first of all, they have the complete genome of all of these individuals. They have weekly blood draws for over a year. During this time, the individuals kept a log and they wore multiple wearables and trackers. And their microbiome, as well as a blood test for compounds that we're going to call the metabolome, was checked regularly on a weekly basis. I think they also ran urines. So you get to see what's going on in the person's body before they get sick. You get to see inflammation start popping up 3 or 4 days before they get their first sniffle. And because of the tracking, you also get to see other subtle things like their oxygen, their heart rate variability, their temperature, blood pressure. You're getting the idea. We've never had the ability to monitor individuals this closely as they go about and live their ordinary lives. And some of the findings that he talked about in this study were just fantastic. So here's a good one, just kind of curiosity. The gut microbiome depends on where you live. If you move to a different area, or you live part of the year in one place and part of the year in another, which many of the people who were among the pioneers did, you get a shift in your microbiome that's quite substantial. Now, the French call that terroir when they're talking about the particular flavor that a soil and maybe a western-facing slope gives a particular wine. And, of course, we have the sommeliers and people who are connoisseurs who can tell you the year and the part of the Loire Valley that this wine probably came from based on subtle elements of flavor. Well, it turns out that's all in the microbiome of the individual. I found that fascinating. Why is that happening? Is it the soil? Is it subtleties in the local diet? Impossible to say. But the diversity of the microbiome is something that we know is deeply, deeply important to health. Some other tidbits that they found was that the blood analytes that you could measure in the bloodstream, those so-called metabolites, also predicted and reflected the microbiome and changes in the microbiome. So when someone got diarrhea, their bacteria shifted in their microbiome and their blood test had a different fingerprint or their series of blood tests. And this allowed them to begin to predict symptoms, such as an attack of diarrhea, by shifts in the metabolome on the blood test. Can you imagine getting a text from your phone saying, you probably want to stay home tomorrow, you're going to have diarrhea? That's the level of fine-tuning that this new technology offers us. Another unexpected finding with respect to the metabolome and the microbiome is that it's not a direct one-to-one correspondence. In other words, different species of bacteria, different microbiomes would produce the same metabolome in the bloodstream. So if one guy is not making hydroxybutyrate, somebody else is, and the level, and maybe there's a feedback loop for that that allows the microbiome to self-regulate. I'd bet on it, actually. Another finding that was unexpected is that people's microbiomes become more complex and unique as they age, as long as they stay healthy. When they become sick, their microbiome becomes less variable and loses some of its diversity before they even start to show symptoms. And it's a real chicken and the egg question. Is some of fragility of aging related to this interaction between the microbiome and the metabolome? And one other thing, this all works beautifully until you get above a BMI of 35. So the people who are very obese, that's the threshold for morbidly obese, is a BMI of greater than 35. All of these connections just drop away. And they didn't have enough people in that group to be able to really tell them what was going on. But I think that to me says, folks, that's a real threat. That's a cliff. Okay, a BMI above 35 isn't just linear, which our epidemiology kind of says it's an ascending slope, getting steeper and steeper. But no, it's a phase change. It's the difference between being steam and being water, or being water and being ice. It's a phase change, and so we really, really need to work hard with our patients who have BMIs above 35. To me, this really shouts out an alarm. One more thing before we go to the break from the talk by Nathan Price. Phenotyping and genetic risk. So they did, as I said, whole genome studies. And they found some very interesting things. For example, about 11% of your bad cholesterol, your LDL, can be predicted just by looking at the genome. But they found that people in the lowest quartile for the genes that predicted a high LDL were able to change their LDLs the most with lifestyles. So they might be genetically having a genetically low LDL, but they had a high LDL on their blood test. So when they did lifestyle, their LDL swatted down rapidly. Whereas people who were in the highest quartiles, in other words, the people who had more of a genetic predisposition to a high LDL and had a high LDL were refractory to lifestyle. So this is another example of how we might select who should get a statin or who should get what treatment based on the genetic probability that they're going to be able to respond to the treatment. The polygenetic score also strongly predicted HDL, the good cholesterol. And as I said earlier, this is going to allow for a big data-derived personal action plan that's tailored for success to each individual's individual genetic strengths and vulnerabilities. This is my discussion of the recent Institute for Functional Medicine annual meeting, and we are talking about some of the interesting research being done by Nathan Price et al. In the Pioneer 100 project at the Institute of Systems Biology. So, in unexpected findings that came out regarding amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease. ALS is a disease that is poorly understood, and they did have some individuals who had genes that are associated with ALS, and they also apparently had one or two ALS people in this cohort, or else they quoted to me research that was done elsewhere. I'm not quite sure which one it was. But one of the fascinating things, we talked earlier just briefly about omega-3s and their anti-inflammatory properties. Well, omega-3s are bad if you have ALS. For some reason, they increase progression. This is only if you have the genetic predispositions. But wow, what's up with that? And exactly what's the mechanism? Well, it isn't clear. Another thing about ALS that came up in the discussion was the fact that there's evidence that people with ALS have a problem handling heavy metals. And so they were looking at heavy metals in the blood of ALS patients. And remember, they're doing these blood tests all the time. Well, at the Pioneer 100, they had some people who did have high heavy metal levels, and they were getting their bloods tested, and they found an indirect, easy test for heavy metals, which is to say, circulating in the bloodstream. It's just an artifact of how we do the blood test. When you draw blood, those little purple top tubes have EDTA in them. It's a chelator and a preservative. So if the person at whose blood you're drawing actually has high levels of serum heavy metals, the EDTA will bind those heavy metals because it's a chelator, right? Well, that's good. But as it does that, it disappears from the analysis. The analysis they were doing should have shown free EDTA from the blood specimens. And what they found was if there isn't EDTA on the analysis, then it means it's bound to something, which means we better check heavy metals in that individual. And I'm thinking, wow, that's really interesting and cheap, I should think, because you can probably do a mass spec for EDTA in the existing laboratory apparatus. And in my opinion, screening for heavy metals like lead and mercury in our population should be done, but it's rarely done because it's typically done in urine. This is something that the commercial labs could pivot to right away. And I just find the idea that it's sort of a accidental or a fortuitous coincidence of how they were designing this study. Moving on in the Pioneer project, we're going to talk about a few trials that they're going to be doing. And one of them is called the VIBE trial. So they're going to be doing this metabolone stuff in women with breast cancer, as well as checking their telomeres. So as women go through their cancer, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, whatever they need, they're going to track those changes. And then they're going to track the recovery. And they're going to see what variations in that group, the women who perhaps go to a vegan, low-fat vegan diet, the women who don't quit smoking, the women who continue to drink alcohol. So all of the variations in a large group can be captured and analyzed, and we can see which are the lifestyle and nutritional factors that allow for the best, most full recovery from the SWAT to your chi that cancer, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy represents. This is a very, very valuable bit of research. Another study is using COCO. I don't know what that stands for. And they're going to be doing analysis of people who are elders, and they're going to watch their brain function. Brain HQ is a thing you can subscribe to and then do tests that have been established quite scientifically to actually improve cognition. And they're also going to look at diet, exercise, sleep, and stress. So primarily sort of a Bredesen approach, but they're going to be analyzing what's going on in the blood, what's going on in the microbiome. And then this one I'm extremely excited about, the Pregnancy Pioneer 200. They're going to be analyzing pregnant women. They're going to have 200. They're going to start at the beginning of the pregnancy. And the big question that they're asking is, can we predict how healthy will be the birth? They're going to look and see if they can identify which aspects of the metabolome indicate a healthy pregnancy. And when there starts to be deviation, what's going on? Are there stress markers? Are there nutritional factors? Can we identify easy to measure predictors of preterm birth? And what measures can we take to reverse them? Because you know there will be some. And even more exciting, this one's coming out of Seattle. They've got a COVID-19 study. They've already got 100 subjects who have survived COVID-19. Some of them are still in their convalescence, and they're monitoring T-cell antigens, proteins, metabolites. They're looking at immune cell phenotyping, what kind of shifts in the immune cells happen over time. They're looking at COVID-specific antibodies. They're looking at polymerase chain reaction sequencing, HLA typing, the people who got sicker have markers, genetic markers on the surface of their cells, and they're doing whole genome sequences in this group as well. So a little bit of preliminary work has come out of China, which shows a correlation between the shape of your ACE2 receptor and the severity of your COVID. It's preliminary, as I say, and it may not tell us exactly what we need to know. I will tell you, because it's a genetic study and it's coming out of China, it will not be generalizable to the global population. Among other things, genetics, along with that terroir we talked about and the microbiome, genetics is local. So I wanted to just remind you that polymerase chain reaction, it's a way of magnifying the DNA so that you can see it. That's essentially how the nasal swab for COVID-19 works, is by polymerase chain reaction, taking a few fragments of RNA on that swab and amplifying them to the point that they can be identified. It's extremely sophisticated technology that has brought us very fast to being able to test. We know that COVID-19 demonstrates very clearly the issue of host variability and resilience, particularly with respect to inflammatory conditions that set them up for a worse disease and a worse outcome. But we also see things like super spreaders and other phenomenon that, if we understand it better, is that a coincidence? Are there certain individuals who just shed more virus than others? These are questions that may be applied to any disease and any potential epidemic in the future. We are poised on the threshold of a birth of a new science, and I am so excited to be here to tell you about it. We're going to move now to discussing food science, and this was a lecture by Christopher Gardner, who is a professor of nutrition. And he had many interesting things to say. The first thing, and I underlined it because I always say this, you've got to read the methods section in any research. But when you're doing nutrition research, it's key. you'll get these contradictory things, like the coffee that I told you about earlier. And you'll get these contradictions because the two studies had different methodologies. They may have used different groups. Here's another example. I said oat bran if you have high LDL at the top of the show. If you have high LDL, oat bran will lower it. But there are plenty of studies showing that oat bran doesn't lower LDL, and most of them are done in people who were younger and had normal LDL, and it doesn't lower normal LDL. It only lowers high LDL. That's why reading the methods is so important. Different context, different results. And what about if you're doing a study of a food? Let's say you're doing a study of how much fish is in a person's diet. So people who eat fish more than 3 times a week. Okay, that's one study. But what if you have a protein in fish that lowers blood pressure and you decide that you're going to take that protein, purify it, and test it on blood pressure? You may get completely different results. First of all, you may not pick the right protein, but if you do pick the right protein, even though you've done your homework, it may work completely different than fish. Plus, you've got a different population. And what else are they eating? So because you're dealing with nutrition studies primarily with wild-type humans, the devil's in the details. And it is stunningly easy to get contradictory results when you design your study just a little bit differently. Another problem with science, food science in particular, is lead time. And so we tend to use surrogate endpoints. A good example of that, lowering the LDL is a surrogate endpoint. Our goal is actually to prevent a heart attack or a stroke 10 years from now. But you can't run a study for 10 years. So we settle for these markers, which may or may not actually reflect disease risk. Another issue is definitions. So, for example, a study of vegetarians could include a group of people who eat a ton of bread and eggs and cheese and very little vegetables, and a group of people who eat a ton of vegetables and very little bread. Now, they're going to have really different outcomes on whatever intervention you make. And if you haven't baked that into the study design, you're going to end up probably not getting any significance because you really have two very radically different groups mixed together, and the variation is just going to cancel things out statistically. By the way, when someone tells me they're a vegetarian, my next question out of my mouth is, and how many servings of fruits and vegetables do you eat every day? Because sometimes the answer is 2. And that just isn't a healthy vegetarian diet. So the narrower you get, the tighter you get. Okay, we're only going to look at vegetarians who eat 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, and we're going to study only this thing. Well, then your results for the effect of thing one on vegetarians will be very rigorous, and they'll be meaningful for vegetarians who eat 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, but they will not be generalizable to the general population. So, which studies have the best generalizability? Well, get rid of single component studies, just toss those out. Whole foods and a broad spectrum of individuals and ages are the things that are going to give you the best science, the best data, because then you can extrapolate to the larger population because your sample reflects the larger population, not, you know, 22-year-old military recruits who are all, you know, male military recruits, because God forbid you should do science on a woman because, I don't know, pregnancy. So what can we agree on? And that was what Dr. Gardner's research was called, what to eat. So what can we agree on? Well, we can agree that we should all eat a whole lot more vegetables and whole foods. I'll come back to the whole foods in just a second. And we can agree that added sugars, particularly simple sugars, and refined grains and processed food and low-fiber food are not good. All the nutrition research pretty much agrees with that. Now, most of the nutrition research agrees on the following: beans, fish, eggs, nuts, and fruits, but not fruit juice. Let me repeat that list again. Beans, good. Fish, good. Eggs, good. Nuts, good. Fruits, good. Not juice. That's good. Well, wait. You said beans. Well, what about Joel Fuhrman and the lectins? And honestly, what are we asking? Okay, are we asking about GI upset or are we asking about longevity? Because it turns out that the diet that's associated with longevity, you can look that up in a book called The Blue Zone Diet, has a lot of beans in it. And that diet also has whole, intact grains. And this is something people always respond when I say whole grains. Oh, yeah, I eat only whole wheat bread. It's like not a whole grain. We're talking about intact grains that look like a little bean. They look like a little seed because they are a seed. And when you cook them, think about rice, okay? Rice is a whole grain. Rice is high glycemic, but whole millet, whole quinoa, whole oats, those are good for you. If you're going to eat wheat berry salad. And actually, learning to cook grains and include them in your diet, particularly mixed with vegetables and some dressing, is a great way to improve the vegetable content of your diet and extremely tasty. Lots of studies get done that don't show benefit, and you spend a lot of money doing these nutrition studies. There was one called the Diet Fit Study. It was published in 2018, and they thought people who are more insulin sensitive would do better on a low-fat diet for weight loss because, you know, they're insulin sensitive, so they're going to process the sugar and burn it. Didn't work, actually. Why not? Well, we don't know. We don't know if there were differences in satiety, differences in the microbiome. And finally, one last point from Dr. Gardner that I think is pretty valuable. When you say eggs are bad, well, eggs are bad compared to what? Eggs are bad compared to Pop-Tarts? So if you tell people what to eat or what not to eat, you also need to understand what substitution they're going to make and offer them the healthier alternative. Everything is a balance, and sustainability is key when we're trying to do dietary modification in humans. So it needs to taste good. It needs to be something you can keep doing. Sometimes people want the same thing every day for breakfast, but we want to encourage more variety, even if it's just two or three different meals, because that's good for the microbiome. And Dr. Gardner actually trademarked the website Unapologetic Deliciousness. I don't know if there's anything up there, but I really like it. Because you know what? Healthy food has a marketing problem. Healthy food has an image problem. They did a study, and I love this one. I hope you'll enjoy it as well. This was at a cafeteria setting, and people could eat however much they wanted. They labeled the carrots high-fiber carrots, and then another day they labeled the carrots twisted citrus glazed carrots. And they measured how much more carrots people ate when they were eating the same recipe, but it was called twisted citrus glazed carrots. And that was great. You know, carrots win under what circumstances? Just plain carrots beat out high-fiber carrots. If you called them high-fiber carrots, no one wanted to eat them. If you called them twisted citrus glazed carrots, everybody wanted to eat them. So one of the things that we have to do as physicians and as public is we need to sell this stuff. We need to do a little creative labeling. We need to emphasize the deliciousness, because eating right isn't just good for you. It's delicious, and we need to help people realize that. I've been asked to make a comment about rice because I talked about it as a whole grain. I did say that it's high glycemic. Brown rice is still high glycemic. So typically, I try to stay on the low glycemic end of grains. So blending the rice, you could blend it with millet, you could blend it with quinoa, you could blend it with wild rice, which is actually not a form of rice. It's a grass and is very low glycemic. So getting it blended in, reducing the absolute quantity of the high glycemic rice, and still getting that lovely mouthfeel and the ability to transport delicious sauces to your mouth, boy, that's a win-win, I think. Something small, something useful. What have I got for you? Okay. Electrical current helps treat people with Tourette syndrome. Now, Tourette syndrome is a dreadful disease. I had a friend in college who had it. You shout out, you have tics, you move your head, you look a little spastic sometimes. You often will have expletives that, you know, should be deleted, but you can't delete them. And it's a bit like trying to suppress the hiccups. The outburst gets worse and worse and worse until the person simply loses control and says whatever they're going to say. Typically, these are stereotypical phrases. It's incredibly socially disabling and just really hard on the person because they are shunned and they're viewed with suspicion and fear. And going through your life like that really stinks. Mostly what's used for this is antipsychotic agents that make you drowsy and make you feel stupid. They work because they slow down the nerve functioning. They balance it. But researchers have found something that works, and it's amazing. A little bit of electrical stimulation to the wrist will allow for stillness and modulate the tics. It turns out that when people are motionless, brainwaves cycle at about 12 times a second in the motor cortex. That's your, you know, that's your baseline blip rate. And all nerves have a tonic rate when they're at rest. The beep, beep, just like the old when you used to be on hold and your phone would beep. Just letting you know I'm still there. Beep, beep. So they found that they could stimulate brainwaves in a magnetic field and they could drop the tics enormously if they went at 12 times a second. But that's not very useful because it's not portable. So what they did was they placed an electrode on the wrist to deliver a mild current with a frequency 12 times a second. Now, this reminds me of those seasickness bands, and I'm wondering if that technology could be repurposed for this. The idea is that the current goes to the sensory cortex of the brain at 12 per second, and because the sensory and the motor cortex are deeply intertwined, it entrains a 12 times a second, a 12 hertz brainwave in the motor cortex and allows people to hold still without having to tense up and focus on that. They've tested, 19 people, and it reduced their tics by close to 40%. And they had a placebo, so sometimes the tics were turned on, sometimes the electrode was turned on, sometimes the electrode was turned off. So this is a study where the individuals had the disease, of course, or it wouldn't have shown you. But it was extremely effective on the average, but a few people, it worked really beautifully. So there's, again, individual variation in response. And I'm wondering if, you know, just having that on a little rheostat so you could turn it up and turn it down, because I'm betting also you could intensify this by finding the right acupuncture point on the inside of the wrist. Master of the Heart 6, a point I use all the time for nausea, comes to mind immediately as the thing I want to check out. I'll probably have to actually look up that article and send that suggestion to the people that they collaborate with, an acupuncturist, to see if they can amplify the effect, because acupuncture, clearly, in my professional experience and my professional opinion, speaks directly to the nervous system, and you can hit the reset button using that technique in ways that I never would have believed possible until I started actually doing it. Just another minute or two. So, herpes virus and Alzheimer's. We've known for a while that in the plaque that forms in the brains of people who have Alzheimer's, will often find herpes virus. And of course, herpes virus on the lip is going to be inflammatory. And we are now framing any inflammation as something that aggravates Alzheimer's. So that makes a little bit of sense. But, you know, we don't need to test real Alzheimer's brains now. We can grow mini brains in a dish. We grow these little human brains, and they are the test subjects someday in the not too distant future, animal testing will be disappeared and we will do all of our work using target or organ culture. The technology is advancing rapidly. In one of these mini brain studies, researchers wanted a proof of concept. They added herpes simplex virus to the brain tissue, infecting it, in other words. And within 3 days, these mini brains formed plaques that looked exactly like those in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. Oh, very interesting stuff. And I look forward to the micro-organ or mini-organ research. I'm sure that there will be a lot of it to share with you. Dr. Don, I hope you've enjoyed the program. I just want to say so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.